From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Tonight on NBC, the drama Friday Night Lights wraps up its first season. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the show's executive producer and creator, Peter Berg. He also co-wrote and directed the movie Friday Night Lights. Both the series and the film are based on the acclaimed book by Buzz Bissinger about the gritty, high-stakes world of Texas high school football. Last week, Friday Night Lights won a Peabody Award for broadcast excellence. Also, New Republic editor Jonathan Cohn. His new book, Sick, is a look at the current health insurance system and how it fails many working Americans. Cohn says it's time for universal health care, and he talks about ways to get it done. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, in for Terry Gross.
Good morning, West Texas. Slammin' Sammy Mead coming at you with Panther Football Radio, 470 AM on your dial. It's Monday morning, and we all know what that means. Only 4 days till Friday night, the night that our Dillon Panthers bring the hammer down on the Westerby Mustangs. Who wants to talk Panther football? I'm all ears.
Hey, Sammy, this is Susan.
The season finale of the series Friday Night Lights airs tonight. And while NBC hasn't decided whether it will be back next year, critics are practically begging for another season of the Peabody Award-winning show about a Texas town's obsession with high school football. Mimi Avens of the LA Times wrote that the first thing anyone who hasn't discovered the show should know is that it's not about football. It regularly deals with issues of parenting, race, class, and drug abuse. Tom Shales of the Washington Post said the show brings plenty of realism, as well as passion, soul, and heart at levels rare in episodic TV. Our guest is the series creator Peter Berg, who also directed the movie Friday Night Lights, based on the nonfiction bestseller by Buzz Bissinger, who happens to be Berg's cousin. In this scene from the TV show's first episode, players are talking to a local news crew about their upcoming season.
We going undefeated, shattering records, taking these high expectations to unimaginable new highs. State champions.
What's after high school, Brian?
Me and Mac Brown gonna get our win on in Pasadena. Get my national championship on, my Heisman on.
It's known that a couple years ago, your father passed away, and he's not gonna be able to
see
you play.
No, look, I don't talk about that, all right? You wanna ask me football questions, I answer you football questions.
Okay. Let's shift gears a minute. There's been talk of racism around this squad. Have you experienced anything like that?
But I don't let that fade me. I just keep my blinders on and keep moving. I got things to do.
That's not racism, man. I just don't like him. He could be from Saudi Arabia or Sweden or Czech. That dude could be Santa Claus, and I still won't like him. Name's Tim Riggins, and I play a fullback.
Peter Berg has worked for 18 years in film and television as a writer, producer, director, and actor. He was a regular on the TV series Chicago Hope. His films include The Last Seduction and Copland. Well, Peter Berg, welcome to Fresh Air. I thought we'd talk a bit about the movie Friday Night Lights first, since it you adapted this from Buzz Bissinger's book about the 1988 football season of the Odessa Permian Panthers. You spent some time in Texas getting acclimated here. Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. When Buzz Bissinger wrote the book, he moved his family down to Odessa, Texas, and lived down there for a year. And I think that time spent, you know, really immersing himself in the culture was very evident in the book in terms of the level of detail and the subtlety that he was able to capture in the book. And when it became apparent to me that the film was in fact going to get made, it was important for me to go back and sort of retrace his footsteps. I knew we were going to shoot the film in Austin, not Odessa, so I chose to spend most of my time in Austin, Texas, with a high school called Austin Westlake High School, just outside of the city. And I spent about 6 months with different families and coaches and their families traveling with the team. And that time spent was, I think, critical in terms of getting myself in the right mindset so that I was able to bring to the screen what Buzz Bissinger did so successfully in his book.
Well, I thought maybe we could hear a cut from the film here. And this is a moment fairly early in the film where Coach Gaines, played by Billy Bob Thornton, is addressing his team not before they're ready to go to battle, but at the end of a practice. They're about to begin the season. And he kind of has a moment with them. Let's listen.
It's a good day, gentlemen. It's a good day to think about responsibility. It's a good day to ask yourself if on a personal level you're willing to accept that. If you're willing to accept the responsibility that you have to protect this team and this school and this town. And make no mistake about it, gentlemen, we are in the business of protecting this town. We're in the business of winning. The expectations couldn't be any higher. We will win state.
And that is Billy Bob Thornton from the movie Friday Night Lights, directed by our guest Peter Berg. You want to say a little bit about that speech?
Well, you know, as I was listening to it, I was tempted to initially respond that it might really not be quite that intense, and that perhaps coaches don't frame high school football seasons in terms of protecting towns and protecting dreams. But I actually do stand by that, and I you know, I'm still caught up in the magic and the spectacle that is high school sports, not just in Texas, but really anywhere in the country, whether it's hockey in Minnesota, basketball in Indiana or New York. You can't help but be touched by the fact that when you go to these games and you experience these communities, the intensity and the level of importance placed upon winning is quite remarkable. And I was certainly struck by my time in Texas with how mature and poised and skillful these young kids, 15, 16 years old, were in terms of handling that pressure. And I was equally impressed by the reality of that pressure, that families really do get caught up, and their identities get very much caught up in the culture of athletics. And winning is very, very important to these communities.
You know, I read a piece by the beat writer for the Odessa American, the daily paper of Odessa, Texas, who had covered the Odessa Permian Panthers in 1989, loved Buzz Bissinger's book, but didn't like the movie because mm-hmm. he felt it strayed so far from the book. And it of course, raises a difficulty that anyone who adapts a great book to a movie faces, which is you can't get it all in. How did you decide what choices did you have to make about that adaptation, things that maybe just weren't going to work in the movie?
That was sort of the big question, how to adapt a book and put it into a 90 plus minute format. And I think the first big decision that I made that, you know, probably irked this reporter from the Odessa newspaper was, you know, what Bissinger did so successfully was he used high school football as a backdrop to explore, very legitimate social issues: racism, education, family values, religion. This was really the heart of Friday Night Lights, particularly issues like racism and education. Those were two huge issues in the book. And I decided not to try and tackle racism as a theme in the film. I didn't think that we'd be able to service it and give it the respect and treat it with the complexity that it warrants. So we dealt with it in a much more subtle manner, and decided to focus primarily on the concept of football, the concept of that one special moment in a life in which everything really seems to make sense, which was certainly a theme that Bissinger hit in his book. And that to me was the most interesting theme. And for all the criticism that Friday Night Lights, the book, took when it came out, particularly in Odessa, Texas, where Bissinger received death threats after the book was published because they felt that they were being portrayed as overly fanatic and racist and people who had their academic priorities, you know, completely backwards. Bissinger really first and foremost presented a world in which sport was a beautiful and magical experience. And Bissinger believed that. And that was what I chose to focus on primarily in the film, and let these other issues percolate, but certainly not dominate.
My guest is writer, actor, director Peter Berg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Berg. He's an actor, writer, and director. He is also the creator of the NBC TV series Friday Night Lights. We spoke a minute ago about some of the challenges of trying to adapt a book with all of the complexity that Friday Night Lights brought to the issue of football and the social milieu it operates in, into a, in, to a 90-minute or two-hour movie. In a TV series, you've got a lot of time to work on some of those things. Was that one of the reasons you wanted to make this into a series?
Absolutely. And, you know, during the filming of Friday Night Lights, I knew that we were not going to be able to really get deep and scratch in a real substantive way the surface of what Bissinger was able to do so well in the book. And I felt very, very strongly that the medium of television would provide us the opportunity to do that, to take 6 or 7 episodes and explore the ways that high schools allocate their resources financially. In Texas, the training departments, the sports medicine departments have larger budgets than English departments. And these were themes that we weren't able to really deal with in a way that was satisfying to me or Bissinger in the film, but we felt that a television series would be a perfect medium to get deeper into these issues, and I've been very happy with the way it's worked out so far.
Now you spent time in Texas, sort of getting into the frame of mind to portray Texas high school football, but the series itself is actually shot in Austin. Now I'm sure this could have been done on sound stages in Los Angeles. What did doing it in Texas bring to the series?
Well, I mean this. Is part of what I was talking about earlier in terms of wanting to make things feel and actually be as real as possible, and it was critical. It was a deal breaker for us. We had to shoot the show in Texas. It's just too unique of a culture, and the network was very supportive of it. We didn't want to build any sets, and we haven't. Actually, that's not true. We built a locker room. But other than that, we shoot the show entirely in real locations with, as many Texas actors as we can. We wanted to avoid bad Southern accents and wherever possible. And I think that, putting the show in Texas was and is a critical aspect to why the show, is working creatively.
You know, I was going to ask you about this. There was a DJ from a Houston radio station who said about the series, if you already have this impression of Texas as a bunch of podunk hicks in the country and all we care about is football and having sex on washing machines, this series totally supports that. I actually don't agree. I mean, I think one of the things I like about this is that you show this as...
I'm sorry, sex where? In washing machines or on washing machines?
On washing machines, which I don't recall seeing in the series.
I don't either. That's a good idea, though. We're gonna do that. Someone's going to have sex in a washing machine.
All right. Well, I hope this DJ doesn't demand credit or payment for the idea. But I do think one of the things that I like about it is that it's not one-dimensional, and it does show the complexity of a culture that is rooted in a real place with real traditions and accents.
I mean, yeah, I'm not clear on where that gentleman's coming from or what his point of view is. I mean, I think that I think there's certainly an inherent sensitivity to how any culture is portrayed, and Texas is obviously a very, very proud and culturally oriented state. It's one of the things that I love about Texas, and it doesn't surprise me that anytime someone, especially outsiders, come and sort of set up camp in that state, there's going to be a response, and there's going to be an inherent skepticism. I remember when I was up in Odessa researching the making of the film. I was at a high school football game in Permian at Ratliff Stadium, 20,000 people on a Friday night watching this football game, and I was standing up in the top of the stadium looking down, and there was a long stairway that went all the way from the top to the field, and real long, a couple of hundred yards. And I was up at the very top, and I was looking down, and a woman was kind of coming up the steps towards me from the bottom very, very purposefully, and she had a baby in one arm and a big thing of popcorn, I remember, in the other arm, and she was just chugging up those steps. And I was watching her, and I was, noting that she seemed to be coming straight at me with purpose. And she got right up to me, and she pointed a finger in my eye, and she said, "Are you here to make a movie about Friday Night Lights?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." And she looked at me, and she was just glaring at me, and she had this baby in her arm. The baby was looking at me, and she said, "Are you going to make us look like monsters?" And it really hit me, and I said, no, ma'am, I don't, no, I'm not going to, no. And she looked at me, she said, let me tell you something, we are not monsters. And she turned around and walked down those steps, and I was, you know, stunned and thought about that for a long time, and, you know, thought about it as I was making the film every day, and thought about it as I was writing the pilot for the television series. And, you know, there is certainly a responsibility. We aspire to honor what Buzz Bissinger did and the respect that he had for those players. And that's the spirit of what we're trying to do. And you know, I don't think you'll see many young couples having sex on or in or generally even near washing machines in our television show.
I want to talk just a bit about the production. You know, I mean, TV series typically are done on tight schedules and scenes are carefully blocked out and camera angles have been carefully considered to get exactly the lighting and the angles that they want. Your technique here is very different. Describe how you do this.
Right. Well, we generally walk into a location that's a real location. So if we're shooting in a restaurant, we just take a regular restaurant the way it is, the way it's lit. We'll generally, you know, approach the restaurant a day before and tell them that if they have regular clientele that come and want to hang out for a day and be part of a show, that they should just come. We use the local cooks, the local waitresses in their costumes. We tend to not dress them. We bring the actors in with a minimal amount of equipment, you know, grip equipment, rigging and lighting. We let them kind of walk around rehearsing the scene. We encourage them to improvise and make the dialogue their own, change things. We don't call them scripts. We tend to call them vague guidelines. And then we come in with a bunch of handheld cameras and we tell everyone to just sort of go. And it's over very quickly. And for people that aren't used to it, it's somewhat traumatic. And they wonder kind of what happened when we say, okay, we got it, and we move on to the next location.
And
Do
you do the scene several times?
We do. We tend to not cut. What we do is we put long magazines of film in. You know, it's our philosophy that every time you cut on a film set, everything sort of comes to a grinding halt, and you have to restart every time you go for another take. So what we like to do is just basically shoot until the cameras run out of film, and then rather than cutting, we'll just reload. You know, if an A camera rolls out, we'll reload that while the other B and C cameras are still shooting. So we'll just keep going and going and going until either we've run out of film or we've got the scene.
How do the actors not step on each other's lines?
Oh, they do. You know, which we like. They'll step on each other's lines. They'll mess things up. They'll get lost and have to kind of find their way out of it. But the actors absolutely love it. And it makes for, you know, a more organic experience when you're doing it, and I think for something that feels a bit more real when you see the finished product.
You know, we had one more cut maybe I thought we would play, and this is a quieter moment. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of really intense stuff, but this is a moment in the hospital where Jason Street, who began the season as the star quarterback, lies at this point possibly paralyzed, and his coach is talking to him, and Street asks the coach how his replacement, a probably underprepared quarterback named Matt Saracen, is doing. Let's listen.
Mm-hmm. How's Saracen doing? Saracen's doing fine. He's throwing like a girl, but he's doing fine. He's doing fine. It'll take some time.
Well, you know, I was kind of like that kid, you know? I don't know, he's a lot different than me. He doesn't need a roadmap like I do, I think. He's kind of creative, you know? Listens to Bob Dylan and draws pictures and stuff. I don't know, good kid. I think you free him up a little bit out there on that field, he'll make some things happen for you.
You're a good man. You're a good man. You're what makes guys like me want to coach. You are a good man.
And that's from the series Friday Night Lights, which was created by our guest, Peter Berg. Any thoughts about that scene, Peter?
I have to say, I find that very emotional. When we were filming the movie, we spent a lot of time filming real playoff games, and we used that footage in the film. We'd shoot real high school playoff games and then cut that into the film. And we were filming a playoff game at Austin Westlake High School in Austin. And it was a game between the Westlake Chaparrals and a school out of San Antonio, Texas. And in the fourth quarter, there was a big, very violent collision. And a 16-year-old boy named David Edwards, who played cornerback for San Antonio, broke his neck. And in that moment went from being a beautiful, extremely athletic, young teenage boy to being an instant quadriplegic and lost all the movement in his body from his neck down. And that was obviously a very, very emotional and profound experience for me and for all of the crew and for everyone in that stadium that experienced that and went through that. And the storyline of Jason Street hurting himself and trying to reclaim his identity after such a traumatic incident was inspired by David Edwards.
Peter Berg directed the film Friday Night Lights and created the TV series. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we look into America's healthcare crisis with Jonathan Cohn, and more with Peter Berg on Friday Night Lights. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is actor, writer, and director Peter Berg. He directed the film Friday Night Lights about high school football in West Texas, and he created the NBC TV series, which explores issues of race, class, and parenting around the football team of the fictional town of Dillon, Texas. Friday Night Lights recently won a Peabody Award for Broadcast Excellence. You've been around television for a long time, and this series has gotten a lot of critical acclaim and has a very devoted audience, but not a huge audience. Why do you think it struggled to find the big numbers that the networks want?
I think there's two reasons that we're struggling with the ratings right now. And I think one was a preconceived idea that the show was going to be exclusively about high school football, and that was off-putting to a lot of people. It was off-putting to women. It was off-putting to high school football players who were concerned that it wouldn't be realistic. It was off-putting to sports fans who were, you know, getting their fill of football. Getting over the initial hurdle of football was a big problem. And the second, you know, problem, which was is equally significant for us, is a question of time slot. You know, you put a new show on opposite. First, we were opposite at this television show, Dancing with the Stars, which was hugely successful, and now we're up against American Idol, which is possibly the most successful show on in the last 15 years on television. And these shows are just beating us up regularly. And we can't win that way.
Well, I thought we'd talk a little bit about some of the long career you had before this Friday Night Lights. And you've done a lot of acting. You were a regular on Chicago Hope. And a lot of people will remember you from the 1994 film The Last Seduction, where you're a small-town guy smitten with a very hard-edged, manipulative woman played by Linda Fiorentino. It's a very sexual relationship. She wants nothing more than that initially, protecting secrets about her life. And that film's all about that relationship. I wonder if you could just describe it a little bit and what it was like playing it.
That film, to me, is really about how we tend to just project whatever we want to upon another person, whether it's a man projecting onto a woman and just refusing to see the reality of who that person is. I played a guy who was so desperate to be in love and to get out of this small town that I was willing to ignore the most glaring of warning signs imaginable, and I paid big time for it. So it's a real cautionary tale for, I think, anyone to not ignore the reality of what you're seeing in a relationship. I think it happens a lot. It certainly happened to me in my life, where you just refuse to see who a person really is because you don't want to, and before you know it, you're in prison for the rest of your life, and you're living a John Lee Hooker blues song.
I think the first film that you wrote and directed was Very Bad Things, right? Which was a black, some would say very black, a comedy about guys who go to Vegas for a bachelor party and end up accidentally killing a prostitute, then just decide to conceal it, leading to further mayhem. I mean, this...
All the wrong moves.
Right.
Right. All the wrong moves.
It was a controversial film. I guess, look, going back, that was in 98, I guess, that you did that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you look at that? Was it a misunderstood film? Would you do it differently today?
I don't think I would. It was my first film, and I wrote it with a large amount of irreverence, and it was fun to write, and I was really left to my own devices, and I was allowed to do exactly what I wanted to do. And at the time, that was really where my head was at. I thought it was just outrageous, and it was very funny to me, and it was funny to the people I was working with, and it's still, I think if you added up the reviews, definitely we lost. And if you look at I'm friends with Michael Mann now, and we were talking about reviews, about bad reviews the other day, and I said, I've gotten the worst all-time review ever. And he said, no, I have. And we were arguing about who got the worst reviews, and he was talking about a review that he had gotten for an earlier film. And I said, well, you got to read Kenneth Turan, the film critic for the LA Times, review of Very Bad Things. You can Google it. You can pull it up online.
I did read that. It's nasty.
Right.
Yeah.
But I say to all my friends now who are filmmakers, I say, who take hits from the critics, I say, look, no one's going to take a harder hit than I took from Ken Turan. And I'm still standing, and I'm, still seem to be functioning in the business, despite his clear attempt to take my head off and make sure I never got anywhere near a film set again. I think if I was still making Very Bad Things today, as the father of a 7-year-old kid and someone who, I think has matured in terms of what he wants to do and say with film, and I'm not that person anymore. And you know, that was who I was at a point in my life. And the great thing about being able to make films is you get the opportunity to grow and you know, mature as an artist. And I'm just, you know, thankful that Ken Turan didn't completely derail my career, and I've been able to make more films.
Well, Peter Berg, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Actor, writer, and director Peter Berg. NBC is still considering whether his series Friday Night Lights will be back for another season. Berg has just finished the feature film The Kingdom, an action drama set in the Middle East. It's scheduled for release this fall. Coming up, Jonathan Cohn on the crisis in American healthcare. This is Fresh Air. A New York Times CBS poll taken in February found a majority of Americans favor a government guarantee of health insurance, even if it means higher taxes. My guest Jonathan Cohn has written a new book exploring the need for health care reform and options for achieving it. The book is an argument for universal health care, told mostly in the form of individual stories, not of the desperately poor, but of working people, many educated and enterprising, whose families were financially ruined and emotionally devastated by illnesses that were uncovered or undercovered by the current health insurance system. Jonathan Cohn is a senior editor at The New Republic and a contributing editor at The American Prospect. His book is called Sick: The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Let's look at some of the case studies that you share with us that illustrate weaknesses or problems in American healthcare. Now, one problem is insurance companies denying coverage or overpricing coverage to people with the very health conditions that make insurance critical for them. And you excite the example of a woman named Janice Ramsey. What's her story?
We catch up with Janice in a little after 2001, 2002. And Janice has built herself a very nice business. She's a consultant working with some realty companies, and she's also taking care of her mother, who's sick at the same time. Her problem is that she has diabetes. Now, if you are part of a large group insurance plan, that shouldn't make too much of a difference, because in a large group, they'll take anybody, and they will price everybody at the same price, and that's fine. But when you try to apply for insurance on your own, or as part of a small business, the insurance industry will want to know, well, what kind of conditions do you have that we're going to be insuring? And if they discover that you have something like diabetes, which she does, then they are going to be very wary of providing that coverage. And in fact, she tried very hard to find coverage, and every policy that came back was either denied outright, or sometimes they would tell her, well, we'll give you the coverage, we just won't cover anything related to your diabetes. Now, if you know anything about diabetes, you know that pretty much almost any medical problem in the world could be plausibly blamed on diabetes. So she did the math and said, well, gee, this isn't really going to cover anything for me. And so she didn't go for any of those plans. And that sort of set her up for the next stage of what was going to happen to her.
Which was what?
Well, as often happens, people in that situation find themselves pretty desperate to find an insurance policy that works. So one day along comes this insurer with a very nice sounding insurance plan. It's she lives in Central Florida, and they're hooked into the best networks of doctors and hospitals in the area. She looks over the plan. This looks great. And the best part is they say they would charge her an affordable premium, and they won't exclude her pre-existing conditions. So she is just ecstatic. She signs up for the plan, and they start withdrawing the premiums, and she thinks everything is fine. Until a few months later, she has to go to the hospital for something. And she gets taken care of. She goes home. And a few months after that, she starts getting calls from the hospital. The bill hasn't been paid. Well, she figures there must have been some mix-up. So she calls up the insurer, and they say, oh, yes, 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 we're just reviewing the claim. So she doesn't think anything of it. Well, a little more time passes. The bill still hasn't been paid. She finally complains to the state. And that's when she finds out that, in fact, her insurer was a fraudulent insurer. And she's been paying premiums to this scam all along. And this actually turns out to be a very common problem. There are literally millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in premiums were paid to fraudulent insurers, many of them doing exactly what this insurer did, which is targeting people who can't find affordable coverage in the small business market or the individual insurance market. And then what happens is these people buy the insurance, and then they suddenly find themselves uninsured, and they really have the worst of all worlds. Now they're stuck with medical bills that aren't covered because, of course, they don't have insurance now to cover them. They can't buy insurance because now they have these pre-existing conditions. And so they end up with medical debts, health problems, and really nothing they can do about it.
So the problem here is people who don't get health insurance from their work, often people who are self-employed. And do insurance companies have complete discretion to deny them coverage or price it so high that it's unaffordable?
Well, different states have different laws, but the fundamental problem here is in the absence of a universal health care system, there's no way to force an insurance company to insure somebody who has these conditions. And when you think about it, in fairness to the insurance companies, they have a good reason for not wanting to insure these people. The old Blue Cross plans, originally they would insure everybody. They offered coverage to everybody. And what ended up happening was eventually other commercial insurance companies came into the business and started picking off the healthiest consumers and charging them lower rates. And what ended up happening was Blue Cross got stuck with all the very sick patients. They had to raise their premiums in order to cover those costs, and then they started losing customers. So for an insurance company operating in a competitive marketplace, there just isn't any way to make money if you're not ruthless about who you cover and who you don't.
Are companies getting more aggressive about seeking to determine what pre-existing conditions might exist? I mean, there's a lot of information out there for people who are aggressive about getting it.
That's right. I mean, they've always been aggressive about that. The change is now is that they have more information at their disposal. And really looking ahead, I think one of the most worrisome trends is the development of genetic technology. Now, we think of unlocking the genome as this great potential for medical breakthroughs, and it is. We might be able to cure all sorts of things. We can screen people for conditions before they develop them. I mean, that is a wonderful medical tool. The problem is that insurance companies can use those tools too, and they can find out that, oh, gee, you're at risk for getting breast cancer, or you're at risk for developing diabetes. Well, they find that out, and they either will jack up your rates or they won't cover you at all. And in fact, there's already been a study out there that has suggested that there are women not taking the genetic test for breast cancer precisely because they fear someday that information might fall into the hands of insurance companies. And that's, to me, a classic example of the way our system, the way it is structured, actually works across purposes with what we want in terms of public health.
You know, I think a lot of people who have health insurance or at least haven't experienced a health financial crisis assume that when people can't afford care, it will be provided and then somebody will absorb the cost. I mean, if you check into a hospital, they will treat you, and if you can't pay, they absorb the cost.
Well, first of all, there are two fallacies with that statement. The first is that it is not true you can always get medical care if you can't afford it. Hospitals will see you if you have an emergency. They are required by federal law to do so. But good luck trying to get preventative care or any kind of non-essential emergency care. That's a whole other story. So people who don't have insurance often have trouble getting access to preventative care, which of course then leads to emergencies down the road. The second problem is that even when they do treat you, they will treat you. They will stabilize you. They will make you better. And they will send you home. And then they will expect to be paid. Now, there is a great controversy over how much they can expect to be paid and what efforts they should make to help you find assistance. But there are documented cases all over the place where people go into the hospital, they don't have health insurance, they get the emergency stabilizing care they need, they go home, and the next thing they know is they owe bills that are five or even six figures. And if they can't pay them off, sometimes they are lucky and they can get taken under the wing by a state agency, or maybe the hospital will write off their charges bad debt, but a lot of times the hospitals will farm out the collections of these to collections agencies.
My guest is Jonathan Cohn. His new book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Well, let's talk about some of the difficult policy issues that we confront if we talk about addressing the problem of insuring the uninsured in America. Now, one argument that you hear against a national health insurance program is that private enterprise can simply do things better. Government bureaucrats will find ways to waste money and provide shoddy care, but an organization that has to meet a bottom line is going to do a better job. What do you think of that argument?
Well, that is one of the most powerful arguments that has been used historically against universal health care. I like to think we've had basically an 80-year running experiment to test this. And the experiment has been, this is basically how we've run our healthcare system. And if you can compare how our private health insurance system has worked against other countries that have universal healthcare, or if you want to compare it even in this country, to the, compare the performance of private insurance versus our best public insurance program, Medicare, I think the evidence is overwhelming that the private sector simply doesn't do this better. The basic problem here is that at some fundamental level, you cannot make money by taking really good care of people who are sick, and you will not make money by helping people who don't have enough money to get their health care afford it. These are not ways that you can make a profit. And the private market, that's what the private market tries to do. It tries to make a profit. And I think our 80-year experiment in this has shown that fundamentally the private sector, the private market, doesn't work very well at providing health insurance. And frankly, there's a good reason to believe the government could do it better.
Now, you say that a simple argument for universal health care comes when you compare what the United States spends on its health care and the results it gets to what other nations spend and their results. What do you find?
Well, again, this is pretty unambiguous. We by far spend more on health care as a percentage of our wealth than any other developed country in the world. And yet we do not have better results to show for it. Health indicators, you know, if you want to look at very crude indicators, how long do we live? What is the infant mortality rate? That sort of thing. We don't do better there. If you want to look more closely at statistics, there are various statistics people have come up with, like potential years of life lost, which are really an effort to zero in on the effect of the healthcare system and sort of void out things like, well, do we have higher poverty here and such. Again, we don't do any better, and in some ways we do a little worse. And even if you look at things like at what rate do we cure various diseases, this is an argument you hear a lot of coming from conservatives who oppose universal health care, and they will point out to one or two diseases where the United States does better. Well, yeah, there are some where the United States does better. There's also some where the United States does worse. And if you look at the evidence as a whole, if you look at the crude indicators, the good indicators, I think it is virtually impossible for anybody with intellectual honesty to make the case that our system is better. And yet we're spending all this extra money. And that's just talking about health outcomes. And let's not forget the fact that we're really other countries don't have this situation where there are major financial barriers to medical care. You don't have masses of people filing for bankruptcy because of their medical debts. You don't have all sorts of people making trade-offs like they do here between, can I afford my rent or am I going to pay for my drugs? You just don't see that in those other countries. And you look at that evidence, you see all the extra money we're spending, and I think you have to ask, how on earth could you say this is a better system?
Well, one of the things that opponents of national health care say is that we're wasting a fortune on malpractice assurance because of out-of-control jury settlements. How much of a drain is that on the system?
Well, there is a separate conversation to be had about the malpractice system. I don't happen to like our malpractice system, and there are, I think, some smart ways we could reform it. But if you're trying to ask the question, as you just did, does malpractice insurance drive up the cost of healthcare? Every study looking at this has suggested it has a minimal impact.
My guest is Jonathan Cohn. He's written a new book called Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Jonathan Cohn. His new book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. When we left off, he was discussing the prospects for universal healthcare. The other argument against a national healthcare system you hear is people will drag up some horror stories from Canada or Great Britain of long waits for care and shoddy treatment. What stock do you place in those stories?
I actually think this is probably one of the most powerful arguments against universal health care politically. And there are a few points to be made here. First of all, there are waiting lines in some other countries with universal health care. Now, those countries spend a lot less than we do. If they spent closer to what we did, they probably wouldn't have such long waiting lines. In addition to that, and purely in terms of health outcomes, it may be that people are waiting for treatment. There's nothing in the statistics to suggest a place like Canada is really suffering serious adverse health effects from it. Again, that's opposed to the United States, where there's a large body of evidence to suggest that people who don't have health insurance are suffering severe medical consequences. We don't see that, at least to that extent, with countries like Canada. But the most important point I like to stress is that there are a lot of countries with universal health care that don't have rationing and waiting problems like we do here. If you go to France or you go to Germany or Japan, all the evidence compiled by the big international authorities like the OECD or the World Health Organization, they don't have waiting problems there. They, in fact, in many ways, they get more health care than we do. They have better access to health care than we do. Americans sometimes like to think, oh, gee, if we have universal health care, we won't have all the high-tech gizmos we want. Well, it's not entirely clear that we actually benefit from having all those high-tech gizmos. But quite apart from that, people who say that should know that we are not the country in the world that has the most MRI machines and CT scanners. That distinction belongs to Japan, and Japan has universal health insurance. So this idea that if we have universal health care, then we're going to have rationing and all be waiting for our doctors, it just isn't true. There are, in fact, countries that have both universal health care and free access to medicine, frankly, freer than we have here.
So do you think the climate has shifted here? I mean, is the groundwork there for a successful movement for universal health care?
The conditions on the ground are shifting. This problem is getting worse. It is worse now than it was 10 years ago. It is going to keep getting worse, and it might start to get worse at an accelerating pace. But I think at this point, there's a lot more work to be done explaining not just what's going on, but why it's happening. And people need to understand that this isn't some complicated problem that nobody can fix. It's actually a very fixable problem. We just need the will to do it.
You know, a number of states are experimenting with efforts to provide universal health coverage. Massachusetts has gotten a lot of attention. I mean, I wonder how – do you regard these as distractions from a needed national effort, or are they maybe laboratories where you can see what works and steps towards a real reform?
I think they are, in general, going to move us closer to universal health care, if only by political example. I think it is highly significant right now that we have two states, one that has passed a universal health care plan and one that is actively talking about creating a universal health care plan.
Let's just be clear. We're talking about Massachusetts and
California.
Right, right.
So now, admittedly,
and Pennsylvania is also talking about some major steps, too. But go ahead. Yeah.
Sure. Yes. No, the states are busy working on this. But to me, I think the Romney and Schwarzenegger examples are really the most vivid because I think they create political room for this discussion. I mean, it was not that long ago when to even talk about universal health care was considered out of bounds. And even in the 2004 presidential election, when most of the Democrats were promising universal health care, with the exception of Dennis Kucinich, none of them were actually offering a plan that would have actually achieved universal health care. So now that has changed, and I don't think it's coincidental that now that Romney and Schwarzenegger have put this on the table, that we see this flurry of activity now. We have private sector interests, we have the Business Roundtable, we have the CEO of Safeway, people like that. Everyone's coming out for universal health care. So politically, I think it certainly advances the cause. Now, whether as policy that helps, that's a much harder question. It is very hard in general to do this on a state-by-state level. California might have a better luck at it than a lot of states simply because it's so big that it has a certain leverage with the insurance industry that other states wouldn't. And they're also, Massachusetts and California are also both trying out this model which is called an individual mandate. And this has become a very popular model for doing universal health care right now. The idea of an individual mandate, the phrase comes from the idea that we are mandating or requiring individuals to buy insurance, to buy private insurance. Some people might still be eligible for programs like Medicaid, which you can keep in place. But the general idea is that we're saying, look, we want everybody in the system, and we're going to make you be in the system the same way that you have to buy auto insurance if you want to drive a car. Well, if you want to live in our state, you have to buy health insurance. Now, if you get it through your employer, that's fine. if you don't, then you have to buy it on your own. And the state then turns around and says, we understand that it's hard to buy insurance sometimes. Sometimes it won't be available to you because of your health conditions, and sometimes you simply won't be able to afford it. So in exchange for requiring you to buy insurance, we will, number one, make sure that there is insurance available to you. We will make sure that even if you have diabetes or you're a cancer survivor, that you can still buy insurance at a reasonable rate. And number two, if you're poor or even not that poor, but you find insurance hard to pay for, we're going to give you subsidies so that you can afford it. And that's the sort of two-way street. You know, you're required to do this. We, in return, will do that. And that is the basic idea behind the individual mandate.
And the drawbacks are?
Well, the drawbacks are it is very easy to say we're going to make affordable insurance available to you. Their problem they're running into in Massachusetts is that it's a lot harder to do that in practice. The insurance companies will want to be paid a certain amount of money. The state will want not to spend more money than it has to on subsidizing people. There's only so much money going around. So there, you would end up inevitably in a very complicated discussion about, well, what should we require people to have? How much should we expect them to pay for it? And how do we actually make this all work? Again, this experiment is ongoing, so I hesitate to say it will or won't work. I think it's very interesting to watch, and I'm actually glad the states are trying this out, because I do think this is a case where, quite honestly, the lessons we see in Massachusetts and California, should they pass this kind of law, would actually be helpful on a national level.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Jonathan Cohn's new book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Finally, we want to welcome our new listeners tuning in to Fresh Air on Radio JIPA in Tbilisi, which is based in the nation of Georgia. Radio JIPA is part of the Georgian Institute of Public Affairs, which runs a graduate program in journalism for students from Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. We hope you'll enjoy listening to the program. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Hope for the best. Expect the worst.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Necessary Sins, a memoir by Lynn Darling about marriage, loss, and the many lessons that can be taught by love. From Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes. Details at Bonterra.com. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, from the new film Gendabind, actor Gabriel Byrne. His other films include Miller's Crossing and The Usual Suspects. Also, the LA Times' Kenneth Weiss on how pollution has changed the oceans, producing dead zones and the sprawling growth of harmful algae. His series, Altered Oceans, just won a Polk Award. Join us for the next Fresh Air.